Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the tech rat. As we've done many Sunday evenings for the last 34 years, this will be TechNet number 1632 of the series that began in September of 1982. Main purpose of the TechNet is that the curious people who want to know more about radio, wireless equipment, meet and exchange information. Quite often a person in the process of studying for his FCC license or starting to operate his equipment has questions as to how do things work, how do things work better, how to make things work better, and if he's got something that's not working as well as he thinks it should, he brings it to our attention. Hey, Jack. The questions that are appropriate for the TechNet are on almost any subject of interest to ham radio operators, and ham radio operators are interested in many subjects. Don't worry because you think your question is too simple. Sometimes we get some pretty deep questions, and we go pretty deeply into them, and that occasionally intimidates people into thinking that only highly technical questions can be discussed. Sometimes some very simple questions can be discussed. Don't worry about that. We don't think there's anything, there's nothing that we declare as a dumb question. A so-called dumb question represents a relatively large difference between what the person knows and what he would like to know. And sometimes the person, because of a lack of experience, doesn't even have a good way of expressing his question. And by way of going back and forth, asking him for more details, we eventually find out what is he really asking, he or she really asking. So don't worry that your question is too simple. Our usual experience is to take questions during the first hour or so, and we take them in the order in which they're asked, and discuss each one of them. And everything you hear on the TechNet is 100% accurate. From time to time, some errors do take place. It's sort of peer-reviewed material, you could say. Every one of the TechNets for the last 11 years have been recorded, and you can play them all back, including this one, a couple of days downrange, by going to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. That's the KC2NJI website, which contains an awful lot of good information. You can choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and play back the whole TechNet. There are people who, the TechNet runs for 4 hours. We start at 8 o'clock and go into to midnight on most nights. And there are people who can't stay up that late, but yet they want to hear it all. So a few days downrange, they can find this particular TechNet being recorded. They download that into whatever kind of an audio recording device they've got, and therefore they can play back the TechNet as they sit on the railroad train, or as they drive to work, or on their noon hour, or whatever. So that's website of mic number one. Mic number two, K1MJM, has a website called LimarkTechNet.com, which also has supporting material that supports the TechNet, pictures, diagrams, articles, and so on, graphs, additional information. Okay, at this time we're going to take chickens. If you do have a question or comment, you're going to give me your call letters, your name, followed by the word yes, and you do have a question or a comment. You need that sign in simply because you're listening. After 34 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So, at this time, give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment.
K2YW
listening.
W2YY Joe, yes.
WA2VDH John, yes.
KD2KNL, yes.
N2XJN, yes.
Okay, we got Joe, John, KD2KNL. Mr. KNL, tell me your name, sir.
I'm sorry about that, Vic. The name is Ed.
Okay, we got Ed and Wes in that order. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now.
John, WK2J. No. Good evening.
Okay, John, with a no. Alrighty. Joe is the first guy on that list. And what's going on in your neighborhood, Joe? WE2RYY. G2RYW in the TechNet.
Well, I'm going to do something a little different here. I'm going to have you put me at the end of the question, a series of questionnaires on the net, because I am doing something just at the moment, and it'll take me a little while, but I have an ear on the net right now, so you put me at the end of the list and let the next guy go online. How do you like that?
Okay, we'll take John. That's Joe. We'll take John next. To me, too. Victor David Hotel. Go right ahead, John. K2RIW.
Okay, fine business. Say good evening to everybody on the net. Okay, Dick, yeah, this has to do a little bit with the discussion that you had with Joe, WA2RYY, I believe, last week, involving the antenna tuner. I agree with pretty much everything you said, but I wanted to mention it last week, didn't get a chance to, about the antenna tuner totally re-reflecting the reflected power from the antenna. And the only comment I have really about it is that for the antenna tuner to totally re-reflect the power, looking into the antenna tuner, you would have to see either an open circuit, a short circuit, or a pure reactance. So I just wonder if you could discuss that a little bit more. Go ahead.
Okay. For the antenna tuner, on the output end, you're speculating, John, that the antenna tuner would have to give a pure reactance on the output end in order to thoroughly reflect all of the power that came back from the antenna to reflect it uprange again. But if there's any resistive component, the antenna tuner would be absorbing that power. And if the antenna tuner was a purely passive device, not being fed by a transmitter, you're absolutely correct. But there's the difference. It's being fed by a transmitter. If on the output end of the antenna tuner, you can see an amount of signal coming from the transmitter, which was equal to the amplitude of the signal coming back from the antenna, about 180 degrees out of phase, those two signals would meet at the output connector of the antenna tuner and cancel, so to speak. So even though there is a resistive component, it is matched by the signal coming out of the transmitter being 180 degrees out of phase, and therefore the signal thinks it's seeing a short circuit and re-reflects forward. That's a guess on my part. I know that you're absolutely right. The only way the antenna tuner could thoroughly reflect all of the power is if it was a pure reactance, or a short circuit, or an open circuit. It is neither of those. It is not a pure reactance, it's not a short circuit, it's not an open circuit. Yeah, because it's being fed by the transmitter at the same time. So, let me drop. A person who's using a standing wave ratio detector on the input end of the antenna tuner, and he's tuning the tuning controls such that the transmitter sees no reflected power, the transmitter sees a pure 50 ohm resistance. In order for the antenna tuner to do that, it's got to take the apparent impedance of your antenna plus its transmission line and convert it. So you think you're tuning out all standing wave ratio, you think you're making an ideal impedance match between a 50 ohm transmitter and some of the crazy impedance of your antenna. The antenna tuner is doing that, but you're not aware of. So at the same time that you're doing that function of making the transmitter see a perfect 50 ohm load, you're not aware of the fact that you're adjusting the antenna tuner for that magic impedance that will take all the power reflected from the antenna. Let me drop for a minute. If the antenna itself was a perfect 50 ohm load, all the power you send down your transmission line would go into the antenna, be absorbed, radiated, and none of it reflected. In the real world, every antenna has got some kind of impedance imperfection. It's not exactly a 50 ohm resistor, and therefore some amount of power is reflected by your antenna in the general case. That ratio of reflected power versus forward power, mathematically speaking, you go through a conversion equation, 1 plus rho over 1 minus rho, where rho is the reflection coefficient in voltage, we call that standing wave ratio. So every realistic antenna has some finite standing wave ratio, some percentage of reflected power. And a properly used antenna tuner handles all that, so to speak. And another way of looking at it is by way of conservation of energy. Let me drop that. A well-constructed antenna tuner is made out of nearly lossless components. It's a well-shielded structure. So of all the power reflected from the antenna, there's only three things that your antenna tuner can do with it. Because of lack of shielding, radiate into space. Well, with good shielding, it can't do that. Because of lossy components, it can turn some of that reflected power from the antenna into heat. Again, if it's made out of low-loss components, it can't do that. The only thing left by conservation of energy is that energy has to be re-reflected forward. If it's re-reflected forward in phase with the energy coming out of your transmitter at this time, and therefore those voltages add. Now, those adding of voltages caused by the reaction of the antenna tuner in a real-world system creates a bit of a problem. A person who puts a bird wattmeter, let's assume the person's got a pair of bird wattmeters. He puts one on the input end of the antenna tuner. He puts one on the output end of the antenna tuner. Let me drop. His bird wattmeter on the input end of the antenna tuner can say that 100 watts is flowing forward toward the antenna tuner and no watts is flowing back. That's what the input antenna tuner, the input bird wattmeter would tell you. The output bird wattmeter might tell you 150 watts is going forward and 50 watts is coming back. And at first the person says, hey, I know my transmitter can only create 100 watts. How come I'm reading 150 watts forward? I can't be real. Yes, it can be real. You can use a well-calibrated directional coupler on that output end of the antenna tuner. You can sample some of that power. The sample will tell you by its coupling ratio that 150 watts is going forward. And the average person will say, hey, that's not real. It's only reactive power. Well, now we're into a sticky area. Because that energy is bouncing back and forth in your transmission line between the antenna and the antenna tuner, you can easily have 150 watts going forward and 50 watts coming back. You're not violating the laws of physics. You're only radiating 100 watts. But because the antenna will only accept a certain percentage of the energy given to it, you have to apply 150 watts to the antenna in order for it to radiate 100 watts of it and reflect the 50. So we're not violating the laws of physics here. We're obeying conservation of energy. And yes, to calculate that output impedance and explain why none of that reflected power gets absorbed by the antenna tuner or gets transferred through it back to the transmitter, that all gets re-reflected forward. Mathematically, you're absolutely right. It's not an easy one to explain. Because the transmitter is continuously there cranking out energy, the power impedance becomes something...
Repeater, timeout.
The apparent impedance becomes quite different from what it would be if the antenna tuner was a purely passive device with no transmitter connected to it. So I wonder if that makes a little more sense, John. And I'll admit this is not an easy one to accept. So the AE2, VDH, good question. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine. This is Vic. Yeah, I have no question about more power in the forward direction after the tuner than what the transmitter is putting out. The part I question is the fact that the voltages are in phase. That's what the antenna tuner does. It puts the voltages in phase, and therefore superposition of power doesn't hold. Just like when you have a quadrature hybrid where when sine waves are at 90 degrees with each other, you can add their powers. Or when sine waves are at different frequencies, you can add their powers. But when you have two sine waves that are in phase, same frequency, then you can't really do superposition of power. And that's really what the antenna tuner does. It brings the voltages in phase. So trying to say that the power is totally re-reflected, I just have a hard time with it. I have an example with some numbers that I could go through on the next go-around. Go ahead.
Whenever you have multiple signals occurring simultaneously, whether they be on different frequencies or the same frequencies, Mother Nature does the exact same thing. Mankind thinks in power. You could say, naively, Mother Nature always thinks in voltage. If I've got two antennas, one I'm transmitting with and another one I'm receiving, some number of miles downrange, and the signal is going from my transmitting antenna toward the receiving antenna, there's a direct path, there's a reflection off the ground, there's a reflection off the tree, there's a reflection off the building. So in other words, there's probably, in the average case, there may be at least 10 individual signals going to that receiving antenna from the one single transmitting antenna. And each of those signals, the direct path and all the bounce paths, they all have a slightly different magnitude and a slightly different phase. And then if you want to mathematically calculate what's going on at the receiving antenna, you take each one of the voltages, not powers, you take each one of the voltages with their phase angle, which means they're now a vector quantity, and you add up, in my example, all of those 10 vectors. That is the resultant voltage you're going to get at the receiving antenna. By the same token, when it comes to the voltage coming out of your transmitter as it's transferred through the antenna tuner, with the modifications the antenna tuner made to do impedance matching. Let me drop. So there's a feed-through voltage through the antenna tuner created by the transmitter. There's a reflected voltage caused by the output end of the antenna tuner, and that voltage is going forward. And now you take voltage number one from the transmitter, voltage number two, the re-reflected forward standing wave ratio voltage, and you add those voltages together in a vector manner. You're not adding powers, you're adding voltages. In the example we had, it is possible for 150 watts to be going forward and 50 watts coming back. And where did the 150 watts come from? It came from the voltage of the 100 watts coming from the transmitter plus the voltage of the reflected power from the antenna, and those voltages being added together. So Mother Nature adds voltages in a vector manner whenever there are multiple signals. And when you carry out that mathematics correctly, whether the signals are on the same voltage or on different voltages, the same frequency or different frequencies, the answer still comes out the same. You add the voltages degree by degree, nanosecond by nanosecond, if you know what I mean. Now, when it comes to discussing a particular impedance of an antenna and a particular transmission line phase length, and then try to calculate exactly what impedance the antenna tuner is presenting in order for all of that to come out right. Let me drop. I'm not sure if it was you, John, or someone else about 6 months ago. We tried going through that mathematics to try to calculate what is the exact impedance the antenna tuner must be presenting for all this to come out right. And that's rather unorthodox mathematics because the antenna tuner looks like a passive device. You could take the antenna tuner plus your transmitter, lump them all together in one box. Mathematically, that's what's happening. They happen to be really separate units with a transmission line between the two, but you can lump the two together. When you do that, you're coming closer to reality. Your antenna tuner, from that point of view, is not a passive device. It's an active device that's adding together in a vector manner voltages created by the transmitter and voltages that have been reflected from the antenna, and makes all of those voltages and phase angles come out right. Mathematically, that's a tough one. You try to predict exactly what impedance you'll see when you look into the output end of the antenna tuner in that circumstance, because it is an active and non-passive device, so to speak. It isn't easy. Back to you, John, the V2VDH, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, fine, this is excuse me, here's an example I was thinking of. I think I gave this example once before with the 50 plus J150 as a load, and then a half wave of transmission line. So at the other end of that half wave of transmission line, we're back to 50 plus J150 again. So my antenna tuner just has to put in minus J150 in series, and I got 50 ohms now. So on the other side of that capacitor, I have a match. So now I could put a 50-ohm generator with an internal impedance of 50 ohms, and now looking back towards the generator on the load side of that capacitor, I see 50 minus J150, which is what you should see when you have a conjugate match. You should see the conjugate of 50 plus J150. So my antenna tuner in this case is just a simple capacitor, but I don't see how I could get total re-reflection of the reflected power. I do agree with you that the power after the tuner has to be much greater than the what the actual transmitter is putting out. Go ahead.
Very fine, John. I recognize these numbers. These are the exact numbers you gave us 6 months or so ago when studying this problem. And yes, your antenna being 50 plus J150 and the half wavelength of transmission line, which repeats impedance. Any half wavelength of lossless line, whatever impedance you put on the output end, is the exact same impedance you're going to see on the input end. So, in order for that antenna tuner to do its job correctly, it would present an impedance of 50 minus J150. And now when you've got signal, you got signal reflecting back from the antenna into that simply calculated impedance, because there is a resistive component there, 50 ohms, you would say, hey, the antenna tuner is going to be absorbing a certain percentage of the reflected power. Good logical conclusion. But that logical conclusion doesn't properly represent the fact that there is a transmitter connected to that antenna tuner that's cranking out another signal, and those signals are going to be adding in a vector manner. So you could say the apparent impedance of the 50 ohms, the 50 minus J150, that you and I could easily calculate as a logical impedance of the output end of the antenna tuner. That 50 minus J150 implies that there is a method by which the antenna tuner would be absorbing power. But because that transmitter is present, it doesn't absorb that power. I know that's not a nice, easy-sounding explanation. But the fact that it has an active characteristic, a transmitter connected to it that's cranking out 100 watts, makes things act a lot more differently than the usual way we calculate impedances. I haven't got an easy answer in this one, John. I will rethink it. I remember trying this once before, the last time you asked this exact question, about 6 months ago. And I didn't come out with a nice, easy-sounding answer. You and I have used antenna tuners. We have seen the fact that they radiate no power. They absorb no power. If they're made well, they run at nearly 100% efficiency. They make it all come out right. Mathematically, it ain't easy to explain. Now back to you, John. WA2VDH. Giving giving us all a tough time. Well done. Keep your eyes up here. You got it, John.
Okay, fine. This is Dick. Yeah, actually, the antenna tuner would just be a capacitor. It would just be minus J150. But I'm gonna think over it some more. There was an article on this very subject. It was in the November-December issue of QEX, 2001, November-December issue of QEX by Stephen Best, Victor Echo 9, Susan Romeo Baker, BE9SRB. He wrote this article, again, November-December 2001, QEX, called Power Delivery and Impedance Matching, Part 3. And it goes into this subject in quite a bit of detail. Anyway, I thank you for your time, Dick, and I won't take any more time on the net, so you can, I'll let you pass it on to the next person. Again, thanks very much for your time.
From that article, Eric Rickenhouse, from that article, how did he explain how everything comes out right? John, go ahead.
No, the one thing he does mention in that article is he said that the tuner does not re-reflect the power because he said the only thing that can totally re-reflect the power, as you said, is an open circuit, a short circuit, or a pure reactance. In other words, anything on the rim of the Smith chart. So that was one of the points he did make in the article. Go ahead.
And did he say what the antenna tuner does? Short circuit, open circuit, or pure reactance? Did he say the next step, John?
From what I get from reading the article is that since the antenna tuner brings the voltages into phase, that the superposition or the addition of power is something that you really can't do. Just as when you have a 2-volt and a 3-volt sine wave that are in phase and you're applying to a resistor, you can't take the power of each of those sine waves and add it up and expect it to be the power for the two that when they're put in series. However, if the sine waves are in quadrature, in 90 degrees, then you can do it. You can superpose the powers. So when the sine waves are in phase, though, the superposition of power doesn't hold. That's the gist I get from the article. But I'm going to read it again in more detail. It's a couple of parts too. Go ahead.
And to repeat that again, whenever there are multiple voltages in any kind of a high efficiency circuit, a low loss circuit, you have to add voltages. You can't add powers. You're on very shaky ground. If on an RF circuit, or any kind of a sine wave-like circuit, if you add powers, you have to first add the voltages and figure out what the powers are really doing. When it comes to reflected power on a broadcast antenna, you've really got to stop the reflection right at the antenna itself. Just using an antenna tuner located at the transmitter end of the transmission line would not be good enough, because there the reflected power bouncing back and forth on the transmission line is going to give you a time delay that back in the analog days would give you a ghost image in your picture. In the digital days, you've now got a time delayed digital signal which could give you inter-symbol distortion and start goofing up the digital wave. My guess is, and you've got some very strict requirements with reference to digital television as to how low the reflection coefficient on the antenna has got to be in order for your transmitting facility not to be creating partial errors with that digital signal, which could make it more difficult for the receiving apparatus to demodulate that signal. I wonder if that's approximately some of the difficulty you guys are now running into, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. Yeah, that's a very real problem, but you got to remember, from the analog days, we really kind of try and tune that out. I mean, the antennas that we used have viz-wise of 1 to 1.06 to 1.05, which are really tiny numbers. Yes, there's a certain amount of inter-symbol distortion the way the system was actually designed. Most of the exciters have an input which they use to build a lookup table to correct the spatial problems that you wind up with. And depending upon how long the feed line is, we're still talking nanoseconds in terms of position, so the longer the feed line is, the more troublesome it can actually kind of become. But the reason why I dropped in for a second, let me have it drop. When you get an opportunity, take a look on a spectrum analyzer, your transmitter, your cracklings, and I switch between receivers, the ones that are furthest away from you is the most pronounced, the one that's closest to you is not as pronounced, so it says to me the RF is jumping up and down. I'm also listening to you directly, and I hear it. So, of course, going through the system it makes it worse, but take notice to it, and one day when you get a chance, fix it. It's RWK2J.
Because I'm running in the full duplex mode, I'm hearing that crackle. I've used my radio mallet, my right hand fist with the knuckles, banged against the transmitter a few times, and I think the crackle has disappeared. A radio mallet. Okay, thank you for bringing that to my attention. Alrighty. Any final comments on this? I guess we've gone as far as we can tonight. I'm going to take your example again and try to make the mathematics come out, John, as I did last time, and I wasn't completely happy with it. So, explaining what is the specific output impedance of an antenna tuner when you've got an antenna impedance of 50 ohms plus 150 ohms of inductive reactance. What is the antenna tuner apparent output impedance? Is an interesting question. By the same token, if you took any of the transmitters that we use, John, the transmitter itself, without an antenna tuner, and with good laboratory instrumentation, it wouldn't be an easy test, look back into the transmitter and measure its impedance while it is transmitting. You'd like to believe you're going to see a 50 ohm source impedance. You would not. Absolutely, you would not. In the case of a tetro tube, let me drop it. In the old days, many of our transmitters were a tetro tube, which is a nearly ideal constant current generator. Our modern transmitters made out of transistors, again, are very close to a nearly constant current generator. So our transmitters provide specified performance when loaded with a 50 ohm resistor. And by conjugate impedance match, you would assume the transmitter is a pure 50 ohm signal generator. Absolutely not. It is a nearly constant current generator that delivers some specific amount of power into a 50 ohm resistor. But itself, it is nearly an open circuit. All the power you try to send back to your transmitter by reflection from the antenna does not get absorbed. The majority of it gets re-reflected forward because the transmitter is a nearly open circuit. So right there, we've got a problem. When it comes to figuring out the impedance matches of everything, because you're connecting a transmitter to the input end of the antenna tuner, and the transmitter itself is this wild impedance of a nearly open circuit, you can see another one of the ingredients of why calculating the situation is a little bit beyond the usual simple law of conjugate impedance matching. Your transmitter into the antenna tuner is not a conjugate impedance match because the transmitter is not a 50 ohm load. Do you see what's going on that one, John? Another degree of the complication. To P2VDH for any other comment, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, yeah, I thoroughly agree with that. Looking back into the transmitter can be something very strange. I totally agree with. It's a very interesting thing. I'll have to really think about it some more. I want to reread this article again, too, that was in the QEX magazine there. It's a very interesting article. Anyway, I do appreciate the comments from the TechNet, and I really appreciate your time. So I'll let you go on to the next person. Again, thanks very much, Dick.
Yeah, you've got a darn good question, John, and we don't have a nice, neat answer for it yet. It's still a slightly open item. We have the faith to know that the antenna tuner does all of that magic, but the mathematics as to how it does it, so far is slightly escaping us. Okay, let's see if Joe is ready now. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in TechNet. Go right ahead, Joe.
W-H-Y-Y. I thought there was more people online than what you had, but anyway, okay. Here's a question. This is probably a very simple one. Part of this I think you've covered already. Measuring RF path loss, you said there's a formula for doing that. I don't recall exactly. It was like 36.4, and I forget the rest of it there, but one of my questions really basing on is not trying to measure the power at a distance, but if you try to measure power very close to the antenna, I guess that formula does not really come into play anymore because you're near field to the antenna. How would you actually do that, knowing the gain of the antenna, the pattern of the antenna? For example, if you're transmitting out of a station master and it's got a six degree vertical beam width, it has an apparent gain of 10 decibels over a dipole, say it has a reading or something like that. If you put 100 watts in, you're supposed to get, say, theoretically 1,000 watts of ERP coming out. But in one particular direction, how much energy would you actually expect to see or be able to measure in one particular direction to know that an antenna is actually good or not?
Okay, first of all, the formula you're looking for, Joe, write this down because it's an extremely valuable formula. If you have pure free space transmission and reception, if there's nothing but free space and there's no reflected signals, no multipath going on, the insertion loss of free space follows this formula. Insertion loss in decibels equals 36.6 plus 20 times the log of base 10 of F in megahertz plus 20 times log base 10 of frequency in megahertz and distance in miles. So 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. F is frequency in megahertz, D is distance in miles. And the fact that you're using D in distance in miles doesn't stop you from using that at 15 feet. 15 feet is some fraction of a mile. It might be 0.05 miles. And you're allowed to put 0.05 mile into the 20 log distance portion of that formula. So that formula works all the way down to zero in distance with one catch. Let me drop. Every antenna has a near field range. A good calculation, it's not perfect, a good calculation for the near field range is 2 d squared over lambda. D is the apparent diameter of the antenna if it's a round antenna. Multiply that times 2, divided by the wavelength, and that in the units of wavelength, in the units of D, is a near field range. In the case of a collinear antenna might have, let me pick a number, 6 dipoles, 6 little sections inside of that radome. Each one of those sections is roughly a half wavelength long. So therefore your antenna is very close to 3 wavelengths in physical length in my example. 3 wavelengths, 2 d squared over lambda. 3 times 2 is 6, divided by lambda, in this case 1. So 6 wavelengths away from that antenna, you would be in the near field. You would be at the threshold between near field and far field. When you're at the near field range or greater range, the antenna pattern becomes real, the amount of transmitted power becomes real, the distance formula for signal strength versus distance, when you're at the near field range and greater, all of that comes out right. Let me drop. Under normal circumstances, if you try to measure effective radiated power from an antenna, and you happen to be using instrumentation that's closer than the near field range, which means you're now in the radiating near field range or the reactive near field range, there's really 3 ranges of an antenna. Super close, they call it the reactive near field. A little bit beyond that, they call it the radiating near field. A little bit beyond that, they call it the far field. So you get those 3 fields. And the far field, no problem. All the measurements of pattern, gain, signal strength, all comes out right. inside of that that third range, in the first two ranges, you cannot use the formulas directly anymore. I'm wondering if that... Yeah, it's coming out of my transmitter, I think. Let me drop. I'm listening now to my own transmitter, and I don't hear it. So I think my signal is not quite strong enough to completely overpower the repeater's noise. Yeah, if I go to higher power, the noise subsides. Unfortunately, this particular transmitter can't tolerate high power for a long period of time without thermally cycling out. So as long as you're in that far field, all the measurements come out. When you're in the near field, the measurements come out crazy. It doesn't mean you can't make the measurements. By the same token, last week someone was saying you can't put a bird watt meter on the output end of an antenna tuner. You're going to get crazy readings. Yes, you can put the antenna tuner there. You can put the bird watt meter there. It's not going to explode. The readings are a little bit crazy at first until you figure out what's going on. By the same token, you can be in the inside of the near field range of your antenna. You can make signal strength measurements, but you've got to use a correction factor. Your next question is going to be, what is the correction factor? The answer to that is a darn complicated. I recommend you try not to make power measurements inside of the near field range. Make sure you make the measurements outside of the near field range. Now, in general, even your station master antenna, at first you might think you have to be a mile away to be in the near, outside of the near field range. Not at all. You take the diameter of the antenna in any one of its dimensions, 2d squared over lambda, and you make a measurement from that range, which in your case might be 16 feet, so to speak. And that's a reasonable range at which you can then measure power and come up with the right answer. Back to you for any repeats on any of this, or any fills, Joe. The B2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
You mentioned 16 wavelengths. Is that because is that knowing that you have that many sections or of dipoles? Is that why you're using that particular number, 16 wavelengths?
You know the physical length of your station master antenna. It might be 16 feet long. You can convert that 16 feet into the wavelength that you're working at. That's the D, the diameter of the formula. 2D squared over lambda. You take whatever that D is in wavelength, square it. I forgot to square it, by the way. Multiply it by 2 and divide by wavelength. That is the calculation of the near field range. So because you know the physical length, you don't even have to know what's inside, how many little half-wave or quarter-wave chunks it's got in there of its semi-rigid cable. Knowing the physical length of the antenna, call that the D, the diameter of the antenna. Square it, multiply it by 2, divide by wavelength, that distance is the near field range. I'm saying it might be 16 feet or might be 30 feet. It's some reasonable distance that's going to fall onto your property. Common sense might lead you to believe you're only going to get the right answer if you're a mile away. In general, you don't have to be anywhere near that far. The near field range on most antennas is nowhere near as big as you think, with one exception. You take an antenna like the 200-inch diameter Palomar telescope, because 200 inches of diameter, where the wavelength in that case at optical frequencies is 450 nanometers, because your wavelength is such an extremely small number, because your diameter is such a big number, and you take the ratio of those and you're going to be squaring it, you calculate the near field range of the Mount Palomar telescope. Because of those crazy numbers, the near field range is beyond the distance of the moon. But that's an unusual case. For your and my radio situations, we don't come out anywhere near that far. Over to you.
Repeater, time out.
So over to you, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW on the TechNet.
Okay, so I'm not sure it's directly answering the question I'm sort of asking. You know, if you try to make a power measurement, what would you expect to see if you had a piece of equipment very close to that station master antenna, like a long-sighted? Would it have to be half the height of the antenna or near the base of the antenna? But if you did that, what would you expect to see in radiated energy at one particular point very close to the antenna, like say 1 or 2 inches away.
Without a big correction factor, you cannot make a measurement 1 or 2 inches away from a station master antenna without a huge correction factor. But the calculated near field range of your station master is some finite distance that easily falls onto your property. Once you're at that distance with your instrumentation could be a sampling loop on the end of a piece of semi-rigid cable, the size of your receiving antenna to measure the effective radiated power out of your station master. The size of that antenna almost doesn't matter. It can be something extremely small, just as long as it's the right range, and you plug it into that formula, 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D, you'll come out with the right answers. You'll be using a very small fraction of a mile for the distance, and therefore the 20 log of that small fraction of a mile is going to come out a negative number. It's going to confuse you a little bit, but overall the whole formula will come out with, maybe you'll calculate the 30 dB of free space loss for your particular distance and frequency. And now, if it was 30 dB of loss, every milliwatt you measure with your instrumentation will represent a watt of effective radiated power out of the antenna. So you have the resources on your property to make that measurement of EIRP of your station master. And go inside of that calculated near field range, you're going to come up with numbers that are bigger than you expect. Simply because in the near field range, the nearby reactive power, in other words, the capacitive coupling and the inductive coupling, starts dominating, and you need this correction factor. You'll come up with an apparent power that in many cases is too big. But rather than get into that complication, your calculation might be 30 feet, and you make the measurement at 30 feet. In theory, you're going to come up with the right number, Joe. W-H-R-Y-Y. Wait for the beeps. K-2-R-I-W. You got it, Joe.
I forget sometimes about the beeps, and so do you. Okay, very good, Dick. Over to the next guy. Thanks.
When you do go through that exercise and make that measurement, let us know what you find out, Joe. I hope it turns out right. And now you've got to be at the right position in altitude from your station master. If your station master happens to have a pancake pattern where the vertical beamwidth is 20 degrees, plus or minus 10 degrees from bore site, so to speak, and you're 15 degrees below the antenna, you're going to come up with a number that's low. You got to be at the right altitude. You got to be in the main beam, so to speak. In the case of a pancake pattern antenna, the receiving antenna's got to be at the right altitude for the numbers to come out right. Next person on our list was Ed. Kilo Delta 2, Kilo November Lima. You've got it, Ed. K2IW at TechNet. My name is Dick.
K2IW, Dick. How you doing? It's KC2KNL, Ed. I got a real simple question for you. I made a little Yagi, a five-element Yagi antenna, and I want to mount it off the top of my house. And I'm just looking at the best way to ground it for lightning protection and whatnot. Do you want to hear what I was thinking, or you want to just give me your suggestion?
Okay, you told us you made a five-element Yagi. And that could have been on 1296, 432, 2 meters, 6 meters. You didn't tell us what frequency it's on. That makes a huge difference in the size of the antenna. And you're going to mount that on your house, and you worry about lightning protection. And many of us do worry about lightning protection. But if you look at your property from the point of view of a stroke of lightning, a stroke of lightning is looking for the highest object in your neighborhood. With rare exception, that's going to be utility poles, trees, mountains, other buildings, and so on. The chances of your particular antenna sitting on the chimney of your house, so to speak, you've got a strap of metal going around your chimney, you've got a vertical mast coming off that strap of metal, going to your rotator, going to your Yagi. And that, as far as your house is concerned, looks like the tallest piece of metal on your house, and it looks like a great big lightning attractor. But the chances of that being the tallest thing in the neighborhood is very unlikely. Let me drop off. I'm sitting here on a piece of land that's very close to 300 feet above sea level, very carefully chosen by me in Dixville because I knew I was going to be a VHF, UHF radio operator. I carefully chose this piece of land, and of all the houses I looked through at that time, this was house number 52 of all the houses we looked at, and this is the one we bought. So, and then I put 100 feet of tower. So my tower, the top of my tower is 400 feet above sea level. I am the tallest thing around in my particular neighborhood for the nearest mile or so. And I, by direct or indirect means, try to keep track of how often I've been struck with lightning. And there was a lightning strike in my neighborhood, oh, about 10 or 12 years ago. Didn't hit my tower, hit local power line, and that power line gave us a great big surge, which damaged all the computers and all of the computer network in the house. A lot of that had to be replaced. My neighbors also had a similar problem. Much of their computer network and television and things like that got damaged. More solid pieces of equipment like refrigerators survived very nicely. So by way of the power line being struck in my neighborhood, I've had a lightning strike. But my tower itself, which happens to be very well grounded, from all I can tell, has never been struck. So how well you ground that antenna on the top of your roof, you're doing it as belt and suspenders. The chances of it being struck are very slim. But if you want to really do it correctly, a piece of 8-gauge wire connected from the mast of that support structure, which with as straight a path as possible, goes down the side of your house and goes into a EIA standard grounding rod, which is, I think it's 5/8 of an inch diameter, 8 feet.
Repeater, time out.
From your electrical supply house, you can buy a known good EIA standard grounding rod. It's usually copper-coated, 5/8 diameter, 8 feet long, pounded into the ground, and your piece of 8-gauge wire connects to it. And now your antenna is extremely well grounded, and I think it's grounded by the standards of the Electronic Engineering Associates, the National Association of Broadcasters, and so on. So that wiring that I just described would 98% of the time absorb a direct lightning strike, bypass it from your house, and connect it into the ground, and be a safe installation. So if you really want to be belt and suspenders, that's what you could do. The majority of us amateurs do not do that. The majority of us amateurs never suffer lightning damage. If you want to go the next step to protect your equipment, every time you're not using it, you disconnect all of the coaxial cables from the equipment. Most of us don't do that. So there is no perfect lightning protection. No matter what you do, the worst case lightning strike could do some damage. No matter what you use for protection equipment, in the worst case scenario, you could still suffer some damage. So perfect lightning protection is not possible, but if you do reasonable things, you'll protect yourself 98-99% of the time. KD2 KNL. This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey. You've got it, Ed.
Okay, thank you for that. One other question just about that. I saw these lightning arrestors, like on Amazon and whatnot. They sell these lightning arrestors that you put in, you know, on your feed line. Do you think there's any value?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hey, you picked up before the beep said, and you did time out. However, I heard you on the input, so I've heard your whole question. So, these lightning arrestors, let me drop. These lightning arrestors that we can buy for our coaxial cable. You buy one of a good brand name. Does it create insertion loss? No. Does it give you protection? Yes. But it gives you protection as far as the signal hitting your antenna, the signal of the lightning bolt hitting your antenna, and a significant amount of that voltage going down the center conductor of your transmission line, entering your transmitter and creating damage. that lightning arrestor will give you protection from that event. But the worst case scenario is that your antenna happens to be directly struck with lightning. The lightning bolt, a small percentage of it wants to go down the semiconductor of your transmission line. A large percentage of it is going to go down the outside conductor of your transmission line. And depending on how that transmission line is routed, in theory, that lightning bolt can then jump from the output conductor of your transmission line over to the house and create damage in the house. That's the worst case scenario. The lightning arrestor that you're thinking of buying does not protect you from that scenario that I just described. So the lightning arrestor protects you from signals being too large going down the inside of the coax. So should you use a lightning arrestor? Yes, it's a good thing to do. Is it a perfect solution? Of course not. The piece of 8-gauge wire I described is the best that we can think of. Putting these spikes across the roof of your house that attract the lightning, all of them are attached to a piece of 8-gauge wire, and they in turn go down to the grappling rod. That's the best lightning protection that we usually know about. So over to you on that one, Ed. 82KNL, HRIW TechNet. Okay, wait for the beeps, but the...
Repeater, timeout.
You've got it, Eric.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out there's a couple of different kinds of lightning protection that you can put in line. Well, BX and Blitzbug make good ones. Those are gas discharge, and you can actually replace the gas discharge capsule because they do fail after a couple of strikes. They also sell devices which are MOVs, and MOVs generally are good for one lightning strike and two at the most, and then they become ineffective. So I just wanted to point that out. K2RIW, K2J.
On the transmitter you're using right now, Eric, there's a little bit of hiss in the background, just like I'm making, and occasionally some cracklies, which is the transmitter doing it, it's not you. When I listen to you on the input, you're noise-free. Through the repeater, there's a little bit of noise. These lightning arrestors that you've just described, particularly the gas discharge type, and Blitzbug and so on, what's the approximate cost of those, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
No, I'm sorry, I wasn't there. That's the other receiver. Let's see. Let me turn off that and this. Oh, no, I just turned it on. Sorry. Let's turn this one on. Come on. I'm doing this on the cell phone. It sometimes doesn't do what you want it to do. There we go. Okay, now you can make a judgment about what this sounds like, but I can't hear myself. So repeat your question again, I'm sorry.
Whatever change you just made, Eric, the hiss that used to be on your transmitter went away. The little bit of hiss on my transmitter is still there. So with reference to the Blitzbug and other and the gas discharge type lightning arrest that you described, what's their approximate cost? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Oh, I actually haven't looked in ages, but they used to be like $30-$40 in that neighborhood. Good ones, anyway. You can get them, there's different kind of connectors on them. TL-259s and, you know, SO-235s on, SO-235s on the input, and a PL-259 on the other end. They come in various different forms, various different sizes. They even make them for the Ethernet cable. So, and the price is very much a matter of fact.
Yeah, two transmissions ago, three transmissions ago, you had some hiss on your transmitter. You made some kind of a change, and the hiss went away. What did you do, Eric?
Okay, I connected to a receiver that's close to me. The receiver that was hissing was actually on the hospital. Here, let's see. Okay, now we're stuck on 20. This is the hospital. That's one. Yeah, hello, 1-2. Now, this is the receiver at Glen Oaks, and this one I'm a little suspicious of. But I've been listening to other people on it, and they've been clean. And I have been listening to you direct, and the crackling noises are very, very weak when I hear them direct, because you put a whopping signal into me. But as I select between Plainview,